You wear suits to work?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I have to wear a monkey suit every day, man.
I can't imagine you in a suit. But
yeah, well, that's my Clark Kent outfit.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm a jeans and boots kind of guy, but, you know, when you work in a financial institution, you got to do what you got to do.
So you can shop for a suit and do this at the same time? You feel comfortable doing that?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm doing it.
Okay. If you take us into the you know, room to try it on, just let me know. Again, thanks for joining me today. This is going to be a little different than your typical Bigfoot show because it's just me. I don't have Paul Vell. I don't have Scott Harriet. I couldn't get those guys together this weekend. But I do have you two, Daryl Collier from the TBRC and Paul Bowman from the TBRC. And these two guys have been kind enough to join me today. So I am recording. This is how the Bigfoot show works. It doesn't really, we don't have any sort of fancy production values or anything. So thanks, guys. Thanks for joining me today.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
And I'm really glad to have you guys on. I've been trying. And Paul, it's funny. Paul has been present for at least two podcasts that I've done. This will be the first time Paul's voice is actually heard, which is pretty impressive.
Did you edit him out?
A coffee cup is clinking in the background of one of them.
What did you do? Edit him out of the other ones or something?
No, he never spoke. He was just sitting there quiet as a church mouse. He was just listening. Yeah, he was there when I did the show with Alton. And
well, that's historic. I mean, that's historical. Don't discard that recording because I don't know of any other instance, any other event where Paul Bowman sat there quietly. And
oh, boy. Here we go.
Word. So...
Here we go.
And then he was with us when we were down in the Big Thicket. He was sitting there for that recording too, for parts of it anyway.
And he never said a word.
He didn't. He just sat there, and I think that one time he just sat there and ate his food and listened to us talk. Anyway, so now Paul, people will be able to hear you. You're actually going to be featured.
I'll try to tone it down a little bit. For Daryl's sake.
Man, so, I've talked to Paul sometimes where you know it's like it's hard to get a word in.
Let's see what happens today. We'll see what happens. So, again, I'm trying to be respectful of you guys' time. Kind of happened at the last minute here. So I'm going to get right to the first question we had. This is from a guy on our Facebook page. His name is Brady Longmore. And Brady says, there might be a lot of people out there venturing into the woods in search of who might not be very experienced with the woods / mountains. Could you talk about the basics in survival, i.e. what do you do if you were lost, have to spend an unexpected night in the woods, the basic gear you should bring with you every time you go out, etc. Maybe you could get a guest who's a survival expert. And you guys actually are, right? So why don't you, could you give me a little background? Why is it fair to call you guys survival experts? Daryl, do you want to start with that?
Well, I was going to let Paul go first, age before beauty.
Oh, Paul, so, you go first.
I'll say quickly that I wouldn't consider myself an expert, but, you know, I do have a military training. You know, Boy Scouts before that when I was a kid. I loved to camp, fish, hike. Anyone that spends any length of time in the outdoors probably reads a lot about it. And, of course, the actual experience is better than just sitting at home reading a book, but it gives you a chance to put a lot of things into practical application. And you learn sometimes by mistake and sometimes by necessity what you've got to do and what you've got to have. And so I would say that with all the time I've spent in the woods on top of my military experience, I wouldn't qualify myself as an expert, but, that's sort of my background. Daryl?
Well, I mean, I would just say, I would differ, Paul. I mean, for Pete's sake, you're an ex-Marine. I mean, you're definitely going to have, you know, an edge over someone who doesn't have that background. I mean, what the Marines go through is just extremely intense and, you know, teach a lot of things. Of course, as you know, I mean, you're a former Marine that a lot of people are never even going to even come close to learning anywhere. So I would say absolutely you would qualify, especially relative to the normal population, you qualify as an expert. My background's a little different than Paul's. I'm a former flyer of airborne Russian linguist in the United States Air Force. And, you know, some would say that it was a pleasure. Some would say that it was just pure hell. But I went through Air Force SEER training, survival, escape, resistance, and evade, which is a pretty grueling. It was a 3-month program for me because I went through special interrogation training and some special programs because I was in the intelligence field. But the survive and evade part, you know, I was out in the woods for about eight, nine days, and you're out there with what we called an element of 7, 8, 9 guys and women. There weren't that many women, but few female flyers. But you're out there for 8, 9 days, and I was in the woods of northeastern Washington, up near the Canadian border, and I went through it in January. At the end of January, February, it was about 6 feet of snow on the ground.
Wow.
And all you had to live in was a parachute with some pine boughs or pine limbs as a bed, and you had 2 military issue sleeping bags, and that was your home away from home for, you know, a little more than a week.
So you had to find all your own food.
Well, you were issued some very, very minimal rations.
Okay.
And there was no food to find with 6 feet of snow on the ground. I mean, we put animal layers out and tried ice fishing. And I mean, we struck out, batted zero in terms of finding our own food. So our diets consisted of, had to have been less than 1,000 calories a day,
okay.
Which is going to be something one would expect in a survival situation.
Sure.
But you know, they gave these little cake things that were just the nastiest things I've ever eaten. In a tin can that looked like a Spam can, it had 5 of these things in it, and you had to last you the whole time. And then each element had 1 rabbit, and the rabbit at the end of, toward the end when the evasion period began, the element would then slaughter the rabbit, cut it up into various pieces, and eat all of it, not just the meat, but all of it. And each individual had to show that they could discard any aversions and show that they would be able to eat what they had to eat during a survival situation. I was forced to eat the lining of the stomach and the stuff that was in the stomach and one of the eyeballs. And you don't
nice.
Cook them. You have to you eat them as they are. And, you know, the lining and the eyeball wasn't so bad. I mean, it was just sort of like a just salty, bloody.
So did you swallow it whole or roll around in your mouth a little while and get a feel for it? Did you pop it with your tongue? I mean, how do you eat a rabbit eyeball?
They won't let you just swallow it. You have to chew it.
You got to like chew it up.
Yeah, you got to chew it. And so you have to kind of, it's like a squirt gun. I mean, and it rolls around in your mouth and it's hard to get it between your teeth. And you have to kind of, use your hand to make your jaw, you know, squeeze on it. And then, you know, finally you get it, and it kind of squirts open and just tastes bloody. Not too bad. Not too much of a flavor, really.
So the anti-interrogation training, if you were ever captured by a squad of Sasquatch, that'll come in handy, I imagine.
Yeah. I mean, actually, a lot of that training, you know, that's from the basic survival stuff to the evasion to the escape training, resistance, and then the, you know, the interrogation training. A lot of techniques I picked up have actually come in handy throughout, you know, various times in my life. Just dealing with people on a regular basis, you'd be amazed at how the interrogation training comes in handy.
I bet. So getting to Brady's question here, the first part of his question is, what do you do if you get lost? If you're out in the woods and you don't have GPS, and you probably should, but if you don't, even if you do, I guess you can get lost with GPS. And you suddenly realize you've been out there for a couple hours, you turn around and you have no idea where you are. What should you do?
Well, I mean, it depends on where you are. I mean, it depends on the circumstances, the conditions. If you're in a whiteout, a total whiteout, a snowstorm, it doesn't matter if you have GPS, doesn't matter if you have compass, whatever. I mean, it's going to be tough to, you know, it's going to be tough to navigate. I mean, I guess a compass would probably help you in that situation. But if you have no compass, you have no GPS, Say for instance you're in a total whiteout. My suggestion would be to hunker down, get your snow shelter built, and wait it out, and then try to get, you know, some sort of aid, like the sun or the stars or something that's going to help you be able to navigate. Now, if you're out in a wilderness area, you don't have a compass, you don't have a GPS, and you get clear skies, then you can always use the sun. You can always use the stars. If you're familiar with the territory, then you would use any sort of terrain marking. If you see a mountain in the distance, Mount Rainier or Mount McKinley or whatever is if you can identify that mountain, then you know which direction it is, and you would use that, and just, stay on a straight line, that sort of thing.
If I'm thinking about this, though, I mean, just the premise of the way that I asked that question is kind of ridiculous, because obviously you shouldn't.
You want to have some sort of preparation.
Right.
At least know where you're at, the general vicinity of where you are. And know well. I mean, like, I'm, for example, if you're going to be in southeast Oklahoma in the national forest, you know that you had to get, go on a highway to get there. You've got to know, generally speaking, that my car is parked back at this campground or a trailhead. So I know there's a road here. I know any farther east, I'm going to be in Arkansas. There's going to be a highway to my north. I mean, you got to have some sort of basic general idea of where you are, what your location looks like, and mm-hmm. what your where there's reference points. And if you just suddenly find yourself out in the woods and you realize, oh crap, I don't recognize this. Okay. And then you get turned around. Like, I'll give a good example. One time we were in the big thicket, and I came a day later, and I knew everybody was out checking cameras, and I used my GPS. I went down known points of reference, a pipeline right-of-way, and I came across to another one, and I headed east. And I knew that where I was trying to go was somewhere northeast of my location in the woods. I knew Daryl and the group was there.
So I'm going to stop you for a second. For people who aren't familiar with the kind of area you're talking about, a pipeline right-of-way is like a really wide, perfectly straight cut through the woods, right? And underneath there's a pipeline buried.
Especially in the big thicket, the woods are so thick,
right,
and dense, and then it's almost like a wall. And then where the pipeline goes, it's like a clear road almost. And so eventually I got into the woods, kind of, and I knew that they were northeast of my location, and I'm in this dense thicket of woods, and I kept trying to use my GPS to navigate, and it was nearly impossible because of the canopy.
Right.
But the point is if I could, and I eventually found everybody, but if I was able to at least discern which way the sun was going to set, I know that if I walk in that direction, eventually I'm going to hit that pipeline right of way again. And so it's just something like that. You always want to keep some level of bearing if you can, just to know, well, if I can find a road, if I can find a creek or a river, or a body of water, then, at that point, at least you're on your way to getting found.
Right.
Go
ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, on the other hand, there could be, I guess, that extreme situation where you are plopped down into an area and you don't have a clue where you are. And I understand that the chances of this happening, people are slim. And it doesn't normally happen this way, but I mean, Paul, you and I are conducting a survive and evade course next month for this very purpose. Suppose you're on an aircraft, you and your buddy are on a little two-seater, and you're the passenger, have an engine failure, your buddy manages to take the plane down, no maps survive, plane crashes, but you survive. In that situation, and I realize that's an extreme situation, but it is possible, and it does happen. Mm-hmm. In that case, you're not going to know where you are. You're probably not going to have much of a lay of the land, and that's when you're going to have to really rely on things like just the natural aids that are going to help you navigate, like the sun, the stars, that sort of thing.
And that is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you guys on, because this question came up, and it was after you guys had organized this survival weekend with members of the TBRC down there in Oklahoma. So
yeah, I don't know how we came up with that. I think I'd seen I saw a video of some guy, some ex Air Force guy, who has a regular camp. I think he holds training camps two or three times a month, and I'm not sure. I think somewhere in the southeast, Georgia or somewhere. And people actually pay to go to his survival camp. It's a 3-4 day weekend, and he trains them. You know, I mean, it's a civilian setting, but he uses all the knowledge that he gained from his experience in the Air Force, and he tries to impart that to the folks that pay, and which is similar to what Paul and I are going to be doing, except nobody's paying for it. We're taking the TWFC members to a pretty remote location. We're going to drop them in the middle of nowhere, and they're going to try to find it to a safe zone. I mean, the supposed scenario is that sort of what I was talking about. You're supposed to go on an aircraft with your buddy. Plane goes down. Unfortunately, the plane goes down in somewhere in Mexico in territory that is claimed by a drug cartel, a hostile and murderous drug cartel. And the evaders, the trainees, will then have to evade to a safe zone out of the drug cartel's area. And the whole time they're trying to survive, and they're trying to evade capture or murder at the hands of the drug cartel. And people may laugh and say, "Well, that can never happen." And I would just beg to differ. It happens all the time. I mean, maybe not necessarily where people go down in the middle of a drug cartel, but you got the elderly gentleman and his son or his grandson that got lost in the forests of New Mexico for 5 days just a few months ago. And I have to sit there and think, well, how in the world did those guys get lost out there? I mean, where they just don't know where they are. I mean, again, you've got the sun, you got the moon, you got the stars, and you should have them, especially if you're going out to a place to camp. You should always have a map. I mean, go to Topo Maps. I think it's topomaps.com. That's where we order all our Topo Maps before we go to any new area. We've got maps. We study it intently. We know where rivers and mountains are. We Paul and I, we get a lay of the land, and Brian, you. I mean, that's what we do before we go into a new area. I mean, we've got a place that we're planning on going up into the Rockies this summer, and all of us have already intently studied the maps. And
one reason why it's so important is that you might say, well, if you can navigate with the sun or the stars, what difference will it make if here I can find north. Well, if I just walk north, well, then what? I mean, you have to know what is north. You have to know,
right.
Okay, well, at least I know, well, there's a highway north of where I came into.
Mm-hmm.
So if I keep going north, I'll hit the highway. I mean, you can't just blindly pick a cardinal direction and just start walking it just because you've determined it. You've got to have some general awareness of the area that you're going into or just use common sense. I mean, you just got to think the situation through. I think that's one of the problems with when people get lost is they panic.
Yeah.
And they find themselves just sort of, in a scurry, just kind of walking. They end up walking in circles often.
Yeah. I should find this and post it to the Facebook page, but there was an experiment done when they put a guy in a field and they blindfolded him and they told him to walk in a straight line. And not just this guy, but multiple people, if you don't know where you're going and you're just walking in what you think is a straight line, you will turn to the left and you will basically start circling around and around and around. And that's just what people do. It's something to do with their ears or something, how they determine what straight ahead is. But there's a slight pull, and I guess to summarize everything you guys are saying is, first of all, have a compass, have a GPS, something like that, if you're going out into the woods. Have a compass. That's like the first thing you need to have, because then you at least know what direction you're heading at all times. Have an understanding of the surroundings that you're in. So be aware, and a map, as you pointed out, Daryl, these topo maps are readily available now. You can get a custom map of any place in the country, essentially. Have a map, have a compass, have a GPS, and have an awareness of where you are, where you're going to be.
Absolutely.
There's one other aspect to this I think that's kind of important, and that's the panic factor. And if you have the confidence, I mean, even if it's cold outside or raining or snowing, but if you have the basic confidence that, look, okay, I'm lost. I don't know where the hell I am, and I don't know how I got in this position. I don't know how to get out of here. But if you have the confidence in your own abilities and know, okay, look, I can survive a night in the woods. I know I can do this. I need to hunker down. I need to be calm. I need to get, you know, find some shelter, build a fire, whatever, and think this through. And because I know I can walk out of here in the morning. If you just know that going into it, if you have the confidence inside that you have the ability to survive, then I think that takes a little bit of that panic out of it, and
yeah.
And you can think more clearly and make better decisions. And instead, I think
yeah,
people
and Paul,
freak out. You know, they just, oh my God, I'm lost.
I'm lost.
You know?
I'm lost. Right.
And Paul's hitting on some very basic issues here in terms of survival. The first thing, the very first priority is to make sure your wits are about you. You've got to not panic. Cannot panic. You've got to stay clear thinking. You've got to stay on top of yourself mentally. And that's the most important thing. And when during the escape, during the evasion period in my survival training, my partner panicked, totally lost his cookies.
No kidding.
And seriously, I mean, we were in a whiteout, man. It was a total whiteout.
Huh.
And we were up on top of a mountain because, I mean, that's what they teach you when you're evading a hostile enemy. You need to go where you think they will not go, or where they are less prone to go. And so, y'all know me. I mean, I picked the most arduous, most difficult route I could possibly take us on. And we ended up going over the top of a mountain, and I'm not talking about Washita Mountains. You know, these were 5, 6, 7 thousand foot mountains,
mm-hmm.
and we ended up in a total whiteout, total whiteout. And he panicked. I mean, he just freaked out. He said, "We're lost. We're never going to find this. We're." I eventually was able to calm him down, and we did make it over the top of the mountain. And went through all that, only to be captured right across the road from the partisan camp, which was a bit of a, you know, which sucked. You know, after you've gone through all that, and the hostiles are waiting for you down at the road. I mean, that was bad. But what I was going to say is the first order of business is keep your wits about you. Second order of business, in particular, in water, because you can only survive a few days without water.
Right.
You got to have a water source. You have to determine some sort of water source. You need a shelter. You got to find a shelter, particularly if you think you're going to be there for any lengthy bit of time. You've got to find a shelter. Because you can go for a long, long time without food. You really can, especially as fat as we are, as in, you know, we Americans are. We've got
right.
stored fat cells. And seriously, those will get us through a long period of time. You're going to be able to survive a long time just on very minimal calories. So you got to have water, you got to have shelter, you got to keep your wits about you. Those are the things you need to be focused on if you're first plopped into a hostile environment. And that's what a survival situation is. We don't think of it as hostile because we wouldn't have enemies chasing us, but it is a hostile environment because one thing you have to deal with is the element. You're going to have to deal with potential. You're going to have to deal with wildlife. And,
yeah. I think there's a lot of, especially in this field of quote unquote Bigfoot research, I think there's a lot of people who are lulled into a sense of security because we're just wrapped in this cocoon of technology all the time, right? And they go out into the woods looking for Bigfoot, and a lot of them, and this isn't a blanket statement, so this isn't everyone, but a lot of them, and I've been with some of these people, they're not prepared. They go out into pretty remote areas, and
yeah.
I don't think they understand how close they really are to being in a life-threatening situation.
Sure.
Without, you know, just by accident, just all of it. Like, again, they could just like walk into the woods and find them, you know, think that they're, you know, a quarter mile from their camp and never find it again or something. So I think it's really important. And I'm glad that Brady brought up this question because I think it's really important. If you're not typically in these kind of situations, or if you don't have training, or if you haven't really thought about it, you could find yourself in a pretty bad spot pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's a show out called I Survived, and you know, a lot of times they deal with home invasions and that sort of thing. But they usually have one case on each show that deals with a situation where somebody was out in the wild and it quickly turned against them. I mean, they slipped
yeah.
and fell down in a ravine and they ended up with a rock on top
real good
of their
example.
Leg.
Yeah, a simple, that's a real good example. If, you know, so I would say an addendum to everything else we're saying is you probably need to be out there with somebody because you could slip and twist your ankle, break your ankle, and then what are you going to do? I think that's a really good example.
I know a lot of people, they like, you know, they like to be, you know, bravado, and they like to, you know, they like to go it alone. But yeah, I mean, you, if at all possible, you need to have a partner with you, because a simple hiking expedition could just turn into a very life-threatening situation.
Yeah.
Particularly if you throw an animal encounter in there, you know, which are rare. And, you know, admittedly, they're rare, but they do happen. We do have a list of reports and statistics where people have been, you know, stalked, hunted, killed by wild animals. And so you throw that on top of the just potentially hostile environment, just weather, changing weather conditions when you're out in a wilderness area. I mean, Brian, Paul, as we saw 2 years ago in the South San Juan, the weather can change quickly.
or not change quickly, and it can rain for 3 days.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you need to be prepped. I mean, there's a reason that the military does, you know, pre-mission briefings. They don't just brief about the hostiles. They brief about everything. They brief about the survival situation. What are you going to do if you go down? I mean, you know, they brief about the terrain, what to expect, you know, all sorts of things. I mean, you need to know about that when you're into an area. I don't care if it is in your backyard. I don't care if you do live on the edge of a wilderness. You need to know it like the back of your hand, and you need to be prepped. I mean, you need to have a basic survival kit with you every time you go out. Mm-hmm. And that basic survival kit should have things that are going to help you to get through a 5, 6, 7 day period, if at all possible. And I'm not talking about food. You're not going to be able to take that much food with you in a survival kit, but you know, you're going to be able to take some things that might help you, like a fishing hook and some line, you know, a mirror.
That's actually a pretty good segue into part of that question, Brian.
Yeah.
If I may say so, I mean, you did ask, you know, what are some of the things?
Yeah. What should you bring? Exactly.
Errol, go ahead. Continue.
Just going to say, I mean, you know, a fishing hook, some line, you know, a mirror, mirror to help reflect the sun. Maybe get a rescue helicopter coming down on you, and he can't see you, but you got that mirror. You can, you know, reflect the sun. Trust me, that pilot's going to be able to see that mirror reflecting from a long way away. Mm-hmm. Something to start a fire with, you know, either wax covered or waterproof matches. Chris Buntenbaugh has a neat little gadget. It's a little, I don't know, what do you call that thing, Paul, that Chris has?
Does it make a spark?
Yeah, it makes the spark.
Yeah, and I've got one. I don't know what it's made of. I wish I did.
There's magnesium. Sticks of magnesium that you can shave. You can scrape shavings off, and then it's got a flint on one side, and you scrape on that, and it puts out some spark that'll ignite the magnesium.
I've got this two-step thing. I've got a little magnesium stick with the little metal scraper, and that throws off huge sparks. And then the other thing is a little tin of like paraffin-soaked wood shavings, which are super flammable. You spark one of those guys, and you know it's not hard to start a fire with that stuff. But you got to have it with you.
You know, I would also say that it's great to have a survival kit everywhere you go. And when we go on our excursions with the TBRC, I always have a small one that I've kind of put together, miscellaneous things like Daryl is talking about. But I would say that if you didn't have one, or if you were just going to be out for a day, and for whatever reason, I'd say probably the most important thing to me anyway to have in the field with you would be a good, strong, solid knife.
Mm-hmm. A good survival knife, absolutely.
Because with a knife, you can do so much. It's great to have a signal mirror. It's great to have matches. It's great to have, you know, all those things. But at the very least, a knife, you can defend yourself with it against an animal.
Yep.
You know, if you were attacked even by a cougar, I mean, you can actually defend yourself with that. Chop wood. There's so many things you can have to build a shelter. There's so many things you can do with a knife. Without a knife.
An animal.
There's been, it's, you know, to me.
You
anyway,
can kill and skin an animal, Paul.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's just to me, it would be the number one survival tool. If I could only take one thing with me, that's what it would be.
And then what knife do you use?
Well, I use a K bar. I mean, that's a lot of to me. There's a lot of tradition behind that. But anything that's I would say a good, you know, 12 inch long, like an outdoor, like a hunting knife. Or I mean, a lot of people will take. Leatherman tools or some variant of that. Those are good because they've got, you know, miscellaneous tools on them. that you might need. I feel that I can get the most out of a long hunting knife, or the Air Force makes a great survival knife. The K-Bar, there's several knives out there now that are really good, sturdy, good quality. Something you could hammer with if you had to. You could shave bark with. You could literally chop down a tree with. It's going to take a lot longer, of course, but you can't really chop down a tree with a pocket knife. Large blade. I mean, there's so much more you can do. And if I had to have one thing, that's what it would be.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can whittle wood down and get you some little wood shavings to start your fire.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, I totally agree with that. Totally. The knife I use is called the ATIC knife, the Aviator's Survival Egress Knife. I think it is. comes with a nice little carrying case that straps down around your ankle and your calf.
Darryl, I don't know if you know this, but the very first knife like that I ever owned, I was probably about 12 years old, and it was that very knife that you carry, that Air Force survival knife. I remember getting it at a surplus.
I don't carry the old one anymore.
And I bought one in a surplus store when I was a teenager. But that's just my opinion. I mean, you can always navigate with the stars, with the sun. There's other little techniques you can use, you know, without a compass. I mean, I'd want to have a compass, but I mean, there's other ways around some of those other issues, but with a knife, you can do a lot.
That's right.
So do you guys have any experience with water purification tablets? I mean, assuming that, you know, we're trying to talk about a small kit here, you're not going to have like a water purification pump. You're not going to be carrying a ton of water with you.
I've used them before. I mean, they're not great, but I mean, it's nice to have.
Yeah.
Well, they work. We use them in Air Force survival training. We used iodine tablets.
Right, iodine.
The water we had was water that we got out of the, you know, once you busted down through the ice, or you had to melt snow, had to make a snow machine, which was just a parachute spread out over a campfire, and you put snow and ice in it and put a little peephole in the bottom of the parachute, and it would drain down into a bucket and tasted like you were drinking, you know, just a canteen full of ashes, but it was water and it did hydrate you. We used the iodine pills, and then we used Tang, the old orange flavored Tang, mm-hmm. which would cover up the taste of the iodine pills because that iodine was just sickening. I got dehydrated because I chose not to use the iodine pills and was just, I put snow in a big, I think it was like a 3 or 4 liter or gallon water container. And of course, snow doesn't melt equal parts for water, so
right.
I wasn't getting enough liquid and went through a period of dehydration. And so I learned my lesson about that. And that's, I know people get tired of me harping on, you got to drink, but that's because I went through something similar.
Well, I remember when we were in the San Juans, I started to get dehydrated. What are signs of dehydration? Because that's a life threatening situation if you don't address it. So what are some of the signs? How do you know you're getting dehydrated if you're out in the woods?
Well, and the thing is, people think because they're in a cooler environment or maybe in a cold environment, they don't have to drink, you know, because they're not sweating. But actually, I would say that you're more at risk in an extremely cold environment than you are actually from a really hot environment. And I got dehydrated. It was, the average temperature was about 5 degrees during the day and about 15 below at night. And, so some of the early signs would be, for me, it was slurred speech.
Uh-huh.
And you're not going to urinate. I mean, if you're not urinating on a regular basis, that's the first telltale sign that you're not taking in enough liquid. You're not taking in enough water and you're not getting hydrated enough.
Right.
You need to urinate fairly regularly. If you stop sweating in a hot environment, you're not sweating, you're dry, that's you're dehydrated.
Headache.
Now, if it gets to,
I get headaches a lot when I start getting,
I was going to say,
that'll happen. That's one of the other signs too.
Your urine becomes
headache,
bright and yellow, and
right.
you know, that was something that I did a lot of training in the desert in California, obviously with my combat experience in the Middle East. But when in training, they really push, you know, you've got to drink lots of water. Your urine
wore us out over
here.
They wore us out over, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Just beat you over the head with it. And you drink, and they will check. It sounds ridiculous, but they'll check your piss.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
If your urine is golden yellow, you're behind the eight ball. You need to get drinking.
Absolutely.
Because
that's right.
A lot of times you can check your, like, the back of your hand. If your skin is not real loose, it's getting kind of tight. That's a little trick to check.
Yeah, there's like a little pinch test or something, right? You pinch it. If it takes too long for your skin to go back down flat, that means you're dehydrated.
Yeah, I don't know how accurate that is, but there's all kinds of different ways. I mean, you start to feel lethargic.
Yeah.
For me, it's always been kind of a headache and sort of a sluggishness.
When I had that in the San Juans, I wasn't sure if it was the altitude or it was the dehydration, but it turned out for me it was dehydration more than anything else.
Well, Daryl's absolutely right. And you tend not to drink as much or think about it as much when you're cold or in a cold environment in
right.
wintertime. And it puts you at great risk for getting dehydrated. So,
the thing is, I mean, and when you're up in the mountains like we were in the South San Juans, you know, we were what 11,000. The air is going to be a lot drier, and it's going to suck every bit of moisture you got in you. It's going to suck it out of you, and so you're going to have to really guard against it. And it was probably a combination, Brian. You know, the altitude sickness or just the lightheadedness from being up so high, and then probably just the lack of moisture as well, you know?
Yeah. So I want to be able to get to the second piece too. So if there's anything else you want to wrap up here in the survival part, I think this is great information.
I just want to, one last thing. I mean, I want to say that when I was in Boy Scouts, I went through the Wilderness Survival Merit Badge course, which for 11-12-year-old was pretty strenuous, looking back on it. But since that time, I mean, since I was a kid, I've collected books, manuals, all leading up to my, service in the military, but there are a plethora of good, solid, survival handbooks and manuals.
Absolutely.
I've got at least a dozen of them on my bookshelf now. I mean, it takes nothing to sit down and read. If you're going to read a book about Sasquatch and getting out and doing research and where to go and all that, I mean, pick up a good book on wilderness survival, and there's a lot of interesting information in these books. Whether or not you ever use those, it's just good information to have in the back of your head.
I also think, and this might sound like I'm trying to cop it out here, but Survivor Man is a TV show. Survivor Man was
great
a great
show.
Resource for that. I mean, he covers all these things: water, shelter, heat, all this stuff.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I would say don't waste your time with Bear Grylls, because that show is just
I totally agree.
He breaks the Ten Commandments of thou shalt not.
He's just making a cool TV show. That's all he's
caring
about.
Sure, he's likable, but
yeah. No, I think in a fight between Bear and Les, I'm going to go with Les every day of the week. I think that's the guy.
Yeah. I mean, the second time I saw Bear Grylls drink his own urine, that's when I said, okay, up here. And that was one of the basic things they taught us. Do not do that unless you are going to die.
Well, eventually,
don't
so the reason for this, because besides it being kind of gross, but, you're just basically continuing to put these salts and these waste products back into your body. And if you can't ever get, if you've turned yourself into a closed system, you're going to die. You're just going to die. That's all there is to it.
Shut down. Your system's going to totally shut down. Now, I do know of one case where somebody did survive because they did that. But, I mean, it's extremely rare, and it's just something you just don't want to do. Your body's kicking it out for a reason.
Right.
You know, it's purging it from your system because it's stuff that your body doesn't want. Now, there's still some fluid in there, but, I mean, when I see Bear Grylls take his shirt off and then pee in it and then wring it out over his mouth, I'm thinking, man, what kind of freak are you? Those steer trainers would have eaten him for lunch.
So when is the you mentioned earlier the TBRC survival weekend? When are you guys pulling that off?
In middle of March.
Middle of March.
Yeah. Oh,
it's
remote. Eastern Oklahoma. I'm kind of hoping that the weather is going to be a little adverse because I want to throw some adversity to you guys.
Sure.
You know, I don't want them to have it.
There's a good chance of that. If history is any guide, the weather in Oklahoma can change on a dime. Case in point, a week and a half ago, it was minus 22 degrees here. And yesterday it was 83. So,
nice.
There you go.
But even in March, your spring is springing, and but there could be spring thunderstorms. There could be a sudden cold snap. There's a good chance we'll have some good weather.
Will it snow down there in March?
It's happened.
Yeah.
Not often,
yeah.
But it has happened. So
yeah, it snowed last March, at least in Area X. Which isn't that far
right,
from where we're going to be.
So.
That's right.
That's an excellent segue. You mentioned Area X. Because our second question, if you guys have time, hopefully we can cover this one in just a few minutes. Kelly Curtis on our Facebook page posted, this weekend warrior hillbilly camping technique isn't working at all. When will someone get serious about this besides your last podcast guest? He was talking about Bill Dranguinis. And fund a few small groups that could do it right. Create groups of females living out in the wilderness for months at a time. Have a set routine that could be repeated in order to meet certain scientific criteria. He goes on to say the purple-haired bird, British bird on the Bigfoot, the definitive guide, show did it in the Congo, didn't she? I'm not sure if she did, but maybe she did. The methodology that they used worked, so why hasn't the BFRO, AIBR, TBRC, ACLU, or any other group adopted this? Yeah, I'm pretty sure the ACLU has stopped all Sasquatch research. I don't think they're doing that anymore. So that's probably
they may be interested in protecting the rights.
I suppose if someone is squashing on the rights of Bigfoot, they'll get involved. But until you can demonstrate that, I don't think they're going to do anything. As much as these guys go charge to go on these expeditions, why can't they fund a team? Just to be clear, TBRC doesn't do
right.
Anything.
That's another topic for another discussion about another group, which is probably not a good idea for us to do. But I would say the biggest issue, well, there's two things. It's time and money.
Exactly.
And most people don't have the time nor the money to do it. If you had a big financial backer, someone like a Tom Slick or somebody like that, mm-hmm. that could really fund something then it gets down to a matter of time. How many people have time to spend 2 months in a remote wooded location looking for Bigfoot? Most people have jobs and families and other obligations, and it's just not.
There's an extraordinarily small number of people who are doing this stuff professionally, and it's maybe half a dozen
right.
in the whole country. So you're talking predominantly volunteer people. Predominantly, they're taking their vacation or their long weekends or whatever. So that's the time problem.
I've asked myself often because I'm sort of semi-retired and myself, and I thought, well, shoot, why can't I? I'm busier now.
Obligations.
It's obligations. That's right. I've got children. I've got other things going on, and it's just like you said. There's just rare individuals that have the time and the lack of commitments elsewhere where they can just devote that kind of time. I think money is sort of an academic question. There are people out there that might fund something like that. I'd like to know where they are right now, the point is that there are people out there somewhere
sure.
that would be willing to do it. It's just a matter of finding them but I just think that's the biggest issue is time and people that don't have obligations. I think that's the biggest hindrance.
Yeah, look at how difficult it was just to get us all together just for this podcast conversation.
That's exactly right, man.
we have two regulars who couldn't make it because conflicting schedules.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we all have obligations, who's the guy who asked this question?
His name's Kelly Curtis. He posts quite a bit on our Facebook page.
Well, I would throw the question back at Kelly. Talk's cheap. Fund it.
Get out there.
Kelly, give us some money, dude. Give us a couple hundred grand, $250,000 or maybe a half million dollars, And then I guarantee you, we will put a team out in ground zero for 6 months.
We've talked about this. So if you go through the list, let's say you do one, because he also mentions at the end of his question 6 months solid. So if you want to put some guys out in the woods for 6 months, obviously they're gonna have to get paid, right? Because they live in the real world, and eventually they're gonna have to pay their mortgage or whatever. So you got to pay them.
There's a way around that. There is a way around that, and that is you have teams go out for limited periods of time, and who will then be replaced by another incoming team, mm-hmm. who will be out there for a short period of time, week, 2 weeks, who will then be replaced by another team. So you do have the continuity. The outgoing team would then brief the incoming team of any activities, of anything they found. The incoming team would then be in there for 10 days or whatever. Then they leave in 10 days, you know, because realistically, people who work like all of us, you know, best you can do generally is 7 to 10 days period vacation before you have to go back and get back into the real world. So that would be one way.
So that's the way to get around that, right? That's sort of like in the best case, you know, real world scenario where you're not going to be able to pay the salary of a team of people, whether that's two or four or six.
Let's look at that though. Let's look at that scenario that you're talking about, Brian. If you had, let's say, $500,000 to fund a 6 month, you know, prolonged research expedition, if you will, and you were able to pay 6 or 8 or 10 people, let's say $30,000 to spend 6 months in the woods, let's just, you know, ballpark figure. You still got to resupply these guys.
Right.
There's a lot of resources that go into that sort of a thing. How do you get the resupplies into them? Are you going to drop it in with a helicopter? Is someone going to drive it in? I mean, it's a major thing. But
are they going to leave and go out and get it, and then, you know, that's going to burn off
exactly.
a lot of their time.
I mean, there's a lot of planning and organizational issues, logistical issues that come along with not to say that it can't be done and perhaps shouldn't be done. But then again, here's the deal. If you got a guy, and this sort of came up in a small way in a discussion that Daryl and I had, and along with other members of the group, about a potential a TV show, you know, people have to get paid because, like you said, we live in the real world. Well, what happens when that show goes off the air? What happens at the end of that six-month period? Okay, so you paid him 30 grand or 50 grand or however much. Well, now is he going to have to go out and look for another job? I mean, are people in your current career going to let you go so you can go off and hunt, you know, chase Bigfoot? I mean, so there's real-world implications after the fact. And so I think that's another issue, another hurdle that has to be, climbed over to get past all that, because it's a great idea. I mean, it's not like it hasn't been thought of before or that question hasn't been asked. I remember, in fact, one thing that led me to get back into this whole thing was I was actually in Desert Storm. We were sitting around late one night watching the jets fly over and on the bombing runs. We somehow got to talking about Bigfoot, and one thing led to another, and it was brought up, hey, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we could send in a Marine recon team, you know, an extended mission, you know, for weeks and or months on end. I mean, who else could do it better but a highly trained, highly disciplined, you know, military unit that can get in unseen and all. And it was a great, you know, brainstorming exercise, and we kind of took it to the nth degree. And I thought to myself, man, wouldn't that be cool when I got back out of this stupid war if I could go do something like that, you know? And one thing led to another, and I ended up in the TBRC. But my point is that it's a great idea. It's a great concept. It's just being able to put that into play. It's just a difficult task with all those variables in place.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I guess the short answer to Kelly would be until professionals take it up that are funded by a university that can stay out for periods of time, 6 months, 12 months, whatever, it's not going to happen. And as long as you have amateurs doing this, you know, as long as you have guys that are, you know, I mean, he makes a lot of us, calling us weekend warriors or whatever. Well, that's the best we got right now. And until somebody takes it seriously, then that's the way it's going to be. And you can call them weekend warriors all day long, but all these people are extremely dedicated and knowledgeable. and you've got a number of biologists.
We're also not a bunch of bubbas out there, you know, drinking beer and shooting off, you know, guns and, you know, shooting cans. And it's not really just an extended camping trip where we go out and have fun and howl at the moon. I mean, that's not what we do. I'm not saying there aren't other groups that might do that, but that's not what we're about. We try to keep it as professional and as pseudo-scientific as we could. I mean, the example I always think of is the ivory-billed woodpecker and all the research efforts that Cornell, you know, put into a few years back. And, mm-hmm. and look at what that produced. I mean, it didn't produce anything. And you had researchers and scientists that were paid to go out and do that. It was funded. It was well-funded. And they still came up with nada, you know. So, not to say that if it was went on any farther that they wouldn't come up with something. But the point is that, you know, it's a major undertaking when people have commitments and financial responsibilities back home. And
it seems like there's three things you need. You need a commitment, like a personal commitment to do it. You need resources. And just to be out there, you know, the ability to get there, the stuff that you need to have when you're there. And then last thing you need is luck. And so it seems to me like you need some combination of all three of those things. And if you don't have much of the first two, then you need a lot of luck. And if you got a lot of the first two, you don't need as much luck. But you're going to need all three of those things if you're going to do this successfully.
Sure. I would agree with that.
Well, perfect. As long as everyone's in agreement with me, I'm a happy chef. So I have another question. One of the things that Kelly talked about earlier in his question is he was talking about groups of females. This idea that you know the most successful primate researchers are women. What do you guys think of that? There are not a lot of women in the TBRC. What do you think about that? What do you think about the idea of putting like an all female team out there?
I'd love to do that. I think it potentially has a lot of merit to it, but again, finding the people who are willing,
right,
who are willing to go out and stay in an extremely remote wilderness area. I mean, that's where we are led to. You know, I know that sure there's some people think these things are right in the backyard, but I mean, the places we're led to tend to be areas where there are, you know, less dense human settlements and extreme wilderness areas. That's what we're led to, and so where I was going with that is it just seems difficult to be able to put together an all female team, you know, that would go and stay. You know, we've got a place where we go fairly regularly. We have a lot of cameras out. We refer to as Area X. It's along the Arkansas Oklahoma state lines. To just getting a team of three or four or five women to go and stay there for three or four days is remarkably difficult. You know. Mm-hmm. I'd love to do that. I've long been a proponent of that because I've noted a long time ago. It seems like there may be an increase in things that happen in activities when the team is made up in part of women.
That's interesting.
I mean, Brian, you were there, and you know when we. Well, in X, the time we had the huge rocks, being thrown.
Oh yeah,
I don't have any other.
We had three or four women with us that time.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and that's not particularly unique as these things go. I mean, it does seem to. I think it is a factor.
Do you think it would work if we just dressed up as women? Like if we went out there and drag, would that help?
Oh boy, here we go. That's how rumors get started.
maybe
we should try it. I mean, anything in the name of science. It seems to me that we should be willing to go at least that far. Go out there with wigs and you know makeup and prosthetics and things like that to make it look like we're women, and we'll see what happens. I'm just saying.
I think it may be.
If you'll eat a rabbit eyeball, you will dress in drag to find Bigfoot. That's what I'm saying.
Well, that's when I was bound by military code. You don't do this, Airman. Guess what? You're walking out of here, buddy.
If you don't put that dress on. Oh, anyway, okay. Well, I want to thank you guys a lot. This has been good. I did this on really short notice. I want to be respectful of your time. I know, Daryl, you're suit shopping right now, so I don't want to get in the way of your trying to buy new clothes. So I think, you know, we covered what I wanted to cover, and this was great. I appreciate the time that you took out of your Sunday to help me out here.
Great. Yeah, my pleasure. And you know, I was just going to say that we can't hope to even, you know, I mean, even with our 3-day survive and evade course coming up, we're just going to scratch the surface. We can't begin to really, you know, teach or really impart what needs to be imparted in terms of survival knowledge, you know, in this short program. But hopefully we've just stimulated some interest and some curiosity on the part of the listeners, and maybe they'll go out and you know, do some research on their own and maybe take an interest in survival and maybe begin to learn some things, you know.
Well, and one other aspect of what we're trying to do, what we're trying to impart to our members is not only some skills that they might need someday, either on their own or in a group outing, but also to sort of raise their awareness of, you know, your cognizance of being in the woods and, you know, not walking around, stepping and stomping on sticks and rocks and clanking things and making lots of racket and lots of noise and smoking and joking. And I mean, it seems somewhat cliche, I guess, but almost treat it like a military operation. If you're out there looking for, it's kind of like hunting. When you're deer hunting, you don't go out there with pots and pans clanking around. And I mean, you're trying to be quiet. You're trying to use, you know, stealth and you know, silence, and you're just trying to move like another animal. And hopefully, I mean, that's going to bring something, or at least not going to alert something that, hey, there's a bunch of Bigfoot researchers coming this way, let's run, you know. And so really that's another thing we're trying to instill in them, is just some basic skills that can be used that might be beneficial to our effort.
That opens up the debate, you know. And I've, you know, a lot of people throwing this at me for years, and then that's fine. They can continue to do what they want, and I'll continue to do as I want. But, you know, well, you shouldn't go out there all dressed in camo and trying to be quiet and all this, and, you know, acting all G.I. Joe. And that's, you know, that's the argument, you know, just go out and make as much noise as you can. And
I mean, I don't understand that, because if our purpose is to try to capture a Bigfoot on film or take pictures or find one so that we can gather trace evidence, tracks or hair or whatever, how are we going to do that? I mean, just because we go out dressed like hunters or using hunting or stealthy military techniques doesn't mean we're going to shoot one. It doesn't mean that we're out to blaze away with you know, with fully automatic weapons. It's just, they're good sound principles. I mean, people, photographers, wildlife photographers, I'm pretty sure that they don't go out trying to catch, you know, an elusive snow leopard, you know, with a rock band in tow. I mean,
and all you have to do is look at the database of the TBRC or even the BFRO for that matter, and there's a large percentage of people who report seeing these things who are hunters, who have guns in their hands.
Well, because they're out trying, they're being stealthy, they're being quiet,
right.
They may be using scent blocking and other things that that hunters use to lure in prey.
Right.
And so in doing so, they haven't alerted the whole woods to their presence, and they end up seeing a Sasquatch. I mean, that's essentially what we're trying to do.
Right.
So, I mean, I know what Daryl's saying. I mean, I can hear people now, you know, oh, look at those guys, you know. But that's really not what we're all about. We're just trying to hedge our bets and better our odds of coming in contact with one of these things.
Let's use the history here. I mean, the number one and number two groups that have reported encounters are motorists and hunters. Both of them sneak up on whatever it is they've seen or whatever it is they're reporting to have seen. They get there, the motorist gets there by virtue of speed, and he's on it before the thing has a chance to react, right? And then the hunter is there, it has the encounter, one would assume, because he or she is dressed in such a way that's going to conceal his position. There's a good chance he's scented in a way that's going to conceal his natural sense. He's probably in a concealed position. He's hidden.
I mean, Daryl, think about the turkey hunter in southeast Oklahoma.
I was just going to mention that.
That's a prime example. I mean, he was dressed like a turkey hunter, so he had a little extra camouflage on that most hunters don't wear. He was fully decked out. He was laid down by the base of a tree in a semi-concealed position, and he was being totally quiet. He was trying to call in some birds, and he was actually using a call. And that's what hunters do, and he ended up having a face-to-face encounter with a Sasquatch at a pretty good distance. And so why would we not try to emulate that? I don't understand that argument. We're not out there, you know, we're not a bunch of Billy Bobs out there trying to impress people or look like some kind of SWAT group or something. I mean, I can see how that might be raised by people, but it just, to me, it's just common sense. I mean, we're trying to use the best skills and techniques that we think are going to better our odds of coming in contact with one. I mean, it's just that
simple. Yeah, and he's one of hundreds like that. So, I mean, we could go on down the list of cases that are similar to that where some guys either he's been very quiet and some of the things that have happened to me were a result of us, you know, observing those sorts of techniques, you know, being quiet, not, you know, watching our steps.
Right.
You know, trying to be as unobtrusive as possible.
Well, it gets back to that luck factor. You know, if you are just, you know, stomping out in the woods and not attempting to in any way be stealthy, you could still have an encounter. And I guess the question is, and there's really no way to measure this at this point, you know, how are you going to increase your odds? And I think right now what you guys are saying is your operating assumption is that you will increase your odds by being more stealthy than you will be by not. And I guess time will tell.
I think so. I mean, I can't see throwing out, you know, not just for purposes of tracking this animal, but for tracking, you know, a lot of different mammals. I can't see throwing out those time-tested methods like
that. Right.
You know, because there may have been some cases where, you know, children were playing in a yard or whatever, and maybe that, which is a different thing. You know, maybe that attracted something in.
Right.
Again, I think the cases that involve, you know, observance of time-tested hunting techniques, I think so far those seem to, you know, again, depending on where you are, that maybe the highest number of witnesses may be that sort of witness.
Yep. All right. Well, we are officially over the hour mark, so I'm gonna roll this thing up now. Again, thank you guys for taking out time on your Sunday. I really appreciate it. I think this has been a really cool conversation. I hope people who were listening to this thought it was good, even though there was no Harriet and no Paul Vella. You know, sometimes this is what we're gonna have to do. But anyway, thanks again, guys. It was great.
All right.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a good one.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. So we'll see you. Bye.